My name is Nick Mottern. I'm director of nodrones.com. That's K-N-O-W, drones.com. And I'm here this afternoon with Kathy Kelly, who has just been released from federal prison after 3 months as a result of her protest at White Man Air Force Base against drone warfare. And Kathy, I want to ask you why you have picked out drones specifically to protest, when this first happened, and when was the first time you realized how deep this problem was? But basically, why are you doing this about drones?
Well, thank you, Nick. There are certainly many, many aspects of militarism and warfare that I believe should be vigorously resisted, nonviolently resisted. But I think in the 21st century, we face a reality wherein the United States military is no longer so interested in a place like Afghanistan, for instance, in organizing and controlling big, huge, sprawling bases. They are instead moving forward with the combination of drone surveillance, usage of weaponized drones, and reliance on the Joint Special Operations Commandos to go into places inside Afghanistan where they believe there may be some threat to U.S. security.
Now, these commandos are essentially death squads, are they?
Well, that might not be the most accurate way to put it. I think we're looking at Navy SEALs, Army Rangers, Green Berets, people that are highly trained, who are sometimes bursting into homes during night raids or paying off Afghan mercenaries or Afghan local police or in conjunction with Afghan army commanders, trying to determine who it is that they believe is a threat to United States interests. Well,
and so the drones are fundamental to that.
Yes, the drones give an advantage in their view because of the aerial surveillance and then the ability to use weaponized drones or maybe call in attack helicopters and simply assassinate people that the United States wants to eliminate. This causes certainly tremendous resentment and fear, insecurity, destabilization, but it also is a proliferating means of warfare. The United States and Israel have shared technology. Israel has sold the technology to China. China has sold it to Pakistan. And so what kind of a world are we moving into? I think this is something that is extremely important for us to look at. And I think we need to be asking the fundamental question, whose lives count? Whose lives matter? Certainly, I'm noticing the parallel situation of people of color in neighborhoods and cities across the United States being terrified that an armed security person might shoot someone simply for being on the street. The incidents of a black man being killed inside United States prisons or jails or by vigilante groups is now, according to some statistics, once every 28 hours. And that's another form of extrajudicial assassination. But with regard to the drone warfare, the CIA often tells people inside the United States Air National Guard bases or military bases who it is that they've decided should be on this kill list. But we very rarely get anyone being held accountable or even disclosing how many people have been killed. It's just as though that kind of counting doesn't matter and the lives of the people killed don't count. So we do, I believe, have a big responsibility to assemble peaceably for redress of grievance and to do that at the place where the grievance exists. And that's why I've gone to Creech Air Force Base with a group of people assembled in 2009, and that resulted in arrest and trial. And we were found guilty, sentenced to time served. We've, as Voices for Creative Nonviolence, tried to help organize actions at quite a number of different military bases or Air National Guard bases, and sometimes done long walks to the actual base so that we can communicate with people all along the route. And I, with Georgia Walker, my co-defendant, carried a loaf of bread, mm-hmm. very symbolic of discussion and sharing inside of many, many, many Afghan homes on a daily basis, mm-hmm. break bread together. And we tried to talk with the commander of the base at Whiteman right. Air Force Base, where weaponized drones are being operated over right. Afghanistan. That's what resulted in a three-month imprisonment.
Right. Well, now, what you're saying, I want to see if I'm clear on it, that you believe that stopping the drone attacks is fundamental to stopping a U.S. strategic plan that is much broader than simply drone attacks.
Surely. I believe that Afghanistan is in the sights of the United States as a place for bases still to be maintained because of more or less a cold war that the United States is waging mm-hmm. in a very provocative way with both China and Russia, and that's why we have this Asia pivot. I don't believe that, in fact, U.S. people are threatened right now mm-hmm. by people in Afghanistan. I think our security would be founded in trying to build up reservoirs of goodwill between mm-hmm. the United States and other people, and trying to deal with the terrible, terrible consequences of war mm-hmm. economically in Afghanistan.
Well, now, President Obama spoke about the fog of war when he was speaking of these two, I guess you would say, non-combatant Italian and American who were killed by an American drone. So what do you make of this fog of war comment?
Well, I think that's a very, very telling instance of U.S. people being vulnerable to being misled. I mean, when you think about the attack on an al-Qaeda compound in Pakistan, wherein two hostages, one Mr. Weinstein from the United States and one Mr. Lopresto from Italy, were being held, along with two United States people who had gone over to actually fight with al-Qaeda. So they've got four people that they didn't know were inside that household mm-hmm. who are killed. And President Obama, in this instance, and for the first time that I'm aware of, a president issued an apology for a United mm-hmm. States attack. By saying that this happened in the context of the fog of war, when you think about fog of war, if white phosphorus is being used and it creates a big, huge cloud that you can't mm-hmm. see through, or if there are bullets flying and smoke and ashes and dirt in panic and chaos, then you'd speak about the fog of war. But in this case, this was a static target and a quiet day. Mm-hmm. The target had been chosen by a group of people who selected it from a list, and the orders to shoot were given when no one was shooting at the United States mm-hmm. whatsoever. And I think that this is something we have to understand in terms of the usage of drone warfare, that these decisions are being made in the context of situations where nobody's firing at the United States or threatening United States people in some direct way. But I would say that there is a great deal of confusion, a great deal of fogginess in the minds of the U.S. public about why we're going to war, who we're going to war against. But there is this tendency to use both fear and then the suggestion that somehow the United States is doing something humanitarian in its responsibility to protect. And so I think we've had, since 2001, the Great War on Terror, and we've made wars now, multiple wars, and it's my belief the United States and all of the military capacity and the weapons in the arsenal cannot make a positive difference in terms of security mm-hmm. or well-being in any of the places where the United States is intervening militarily.
Well, what would you say to people who are afraid of ISIS?
I believe that the visual image of someone who is a hostage being beheaded in a ghastly way that celebrates the death is vicious, it's horrible, and it's frightening. Mm-hmm. I believe it's also important that we recognize that when the United States in the past in Iraq could be displayed saying, as some soldiers did following the Desert Storm battles, it was like shooting fish in a barrel. That was mm-hmm. ghastly. When People went into bars during the Desert Storm bombing and could be on film lifting up glasses of beer, saying, "Rock Iraq, slam Saddam, say hello to Allah." Mm-hmm. This is unsettling. When Madeleine Albright said, "Well, it's a difficult choice to make. I'm a humanitarian person, but the price, we think the price is worth it." This is how she responded to Leslie Stahl, asking her about 500,000 Iraqi children who were brutally and lethally punished to death by economic sanctions. When George Bush is joking about looking for weapons of mass destruction under his desk, making a joke about what had happened after the shock and awe bombing, when in fact there was no basis whatsoever for the military intervention in that country. We see it again and again and again, where U.S. people are kind of either celebratory, dismissive, or humorous about United States war making. Well, of course, this is going to have consequences in people in other lands who can't escape our wars and want to in some way fight back are going to pick up weapons and train one another in ways to fight. I visited the Bukka compound where Ali Baghdadi, who recently was severely wounded by a U.S. drone attack, had been imprisoned for 4 to 5 years, 4 to 5 years, and he recruited other ISIS fighters during that time, and it was a hideous prison. It was one of the worst places I've ever been in my life. Honestly, I was spitting flies out of my mouth, and the sand was black, and at the time, the prison was a tent imprisonment. And I'll never forget young boys telling me, "We're so humiliated, we were paraded naked in front of United States women soldiers." So these seeds of trauma, anger, and violence are planted by United States wars. Now, can the United States possibly build up, nevertheless, in spite of all this violence, some reservoir of goodwill in these regions? I look at the United Nations trying to both create and sustain new and burgeoning refugee camps and try to deal with the huge numbers of people who flee from ISIS and wonder, well, where are we going to go? What are we going to do? The date given now to new refugees in these refugee camps for some kind of possible resettlement is 2022 to 2024. Well, when you look at the resources the United States pours and the billions of dollars into the military interventions in these areas, we would have the wherewithal, the skill, the productivity, and the organizational capacity to seriously help UN agencies in creating a dignified life for refugees who fled from our wars. We could do that, and I would think that that's a legitimate way for the United States to be present in these areas. I mean, look at little tiny Cuba, a country which is beloved all around the world. Floods ravaged Pakistan, and there's a Cuban doctors going in to help, and a year later they're still there helping. We could be so much different, but instead we have earned as a country a reputation as a menacing, fearsome country, which has said to people all around the world, either you subordinate yourselves to serve our national interest, or we might eliminate you.
Now, you spent this 3 months in prison, which is a separation from the general society here to a certain degree. Do you have any observations about what might what path, you know, people with our concerns might want to follow, that you, any suggestions, any thoughts that you didn't have before you spent that time in prison? I heard you once say that you felt, and the way things are, it might be that being in prison is the only place to be in the face of, you know, the horrors that are being generated by imperialism, I guess. But I just wonder, you know, and certainly there's a spiritual element to being able to carry forward with this. So if any of those things you want to respond to, I think it would be helpful for people.
Well, I've been very fortunate in my life to be able to go over to several other countries and be with ordinary people, often people who are just on the edge of survival in terms of their human needs being met, and live alongside people and try to understand their plight, trapped under the horrible burdens of United States attacks, both in Iraq and in Afghanistan, for instance. When you go inside of a prison, I think you're also being given a chance to live with ordinary people who've been attacked by what I would call a war against the poor in the United States. Mm-hmm. And we've seen systematic ways in which there has been a reenactment of enslavement by the usage of the system of imprisoning people for long periods of time, which causes breakdown of families, breakdown of communities, and a greater likelihood of impoverishment when people are released. And I think it's crucial to hear from the people who are trapped in this prison system as in as close a conversation as might be possible. And you do get that opportunity when you go into a prison. I also think that you don't get freedom, you take it. And if we don't exercise our constitutional right to assemble peaceably for redress of grievance, we might as well not have that right. Now, many judges feel that their primary responsibility is to protect the military and protect the weapons if you're charged with criminal trespass to a military installation. But I don't think we should be deterred by that proclivity of the judges in terms of how they determine their mission. I think we should be fearless in speaking up to the judges and speaking out to the courts, and in saying that we simply won't be deterred by sentences that place us possibly in prisons. But I also want to recognize that there are many people who'd have to say, well, quite honestly, that's just not something I can risk. Right. Or there are many others who say, well, you're a white woman and you're going to be treated differently than I'll be treated if the person is a person of color. Certainly people of color are disproportionately represented within the prison system as is.
Yes. So is your view that we should pretty much continue on the path that we're on in terms of education, or do you think that there is a need to do more civil disobedience?
I don't want to create a hierarchy that says this.
Well, I'm talking about strategies more than one's better than the other. I'm saying that sometimes people will feel, okay, now things have taken on a different character. So I might want to have to go farther or further than I would have otherwise. There may be other things that are inspirations to people because of the urgency of the circumstances. So I'm just saying how you feel maybe about the urgency of the circumstances rather than a recommendation, if you don't do this, you're no good.
Ooh, okay. Well, I was probably about to enunciate a contradiction anyway, because I want to say that I don't see a hierarchy, that every place where people find them, you know, Kurt Vonnegut used to say, get yourself a gang, where every place where people find a group of kindred spirits and get to work is needed and important. But I do think we are at an extremely critical time. I think that it's not hyperbolic to say that it's as though a train were getting to an abyss and about to go over. And sure, I've been riding in the first class car in my well-endowed life, and it's almost as though I and many others are saying, well, we like the view. And that's true.
Yeah.
But the crucial time for stopping the train is now. I think the planet may not be habitable or sustainable if we continue to withdraw the fuels from underneath the Earth's surface. We already can see what the water shortages are creating in different parts of the planet. That's related to overconsumption. We've certainly got problems with pollution, and the greatest offender in that regard is the United States military, the largest consumer of fossil fuels in the United States today. So are we going to cooperate with U.S. militarism? If we try to keep giving the Pentagon everything that it demands and what Martin Luther King likened us to a demonic suction cup, there's simply not going to be enough left over to meet the needs of coping with the greatest terror we face, the terror of what we're doing to our environment, and then the needs of a neglected infrastructure and so many populations within the United States that are subjected to poverty.
Right. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we wind it up?
I think if we make the needs of the poorest in our world and amongst our communities, our number one priority. Mm-hmm. Many other questions get resolved in a sane way if we keep one foot firmly planted amongst those who are bearing the burdens of our war, mm-hmm. and one foot planted amongst those who are struggling to make a difference. We'll find our equilibrium.
Great.
Thank you, Nick.